Side 6. The Gods Themselves. Continuing on page 211. I see, Doctor, but I take it seriously. To me, the warning was second time round, you understand? The report of the first warning, from you, had never reached the Senator. It had nothing to do with financial irregularities, which were what was then on his mind. The actual head of the investigating panel, not myself, considered it, you will forgive me, crackpot. I did not. When the matter came up again, I grew disturbed. It was my intention to meet with Lamont, but a number of physicists whom I consulted, including Hallam? No, I did not see Hallam. A number of those I consulted advised me that Lamont's work was utterly without foundation. Even so, I was considering seeing him when I was asked to take up this position, and here I am, and here you are. So you see why I had to see you. In your opinion, is there merit in the theories advanced by yourself and by Dr. Lamont? You mean, is continued use of the electron pump going to blow up the sun, or maybe the entire arm of the galaxy? Yes, that's exactly what I mean. How can I tell you? All I have is my own guess, which is just a guess. As for Lamont's theory, I have not studied it in detail. It has not been published. If I saw it, the mathematics might be beyond me. Besides, what's the difference? Lamont won't convince anyone. Hallam has ruined him as earlier he ruined me, and the public generally would find it against their short-term interest to believe him, even if he went over Hallam's head, so to speak. They don't want to give up the pump, and it's a lot easier to refuse to accept Lamont's theory than to try to do something about it. But you're still concerned about it, aren't you? In the sense that I think we might indeed destroy ourselves and that I wouldn't like to see that happen, of course. So you've come to the moon now to do something that Hallam, your old enemy, would prevent your doing on Earth. Dennison said slowly, You, too, like to make guesses. Do I? Said Gottstein indifferently. Perhaps I am brilliant, too. Is my guess correct? It may be. I haven't given up hope of returning to science. If anything I do were to lift the specter of doom from mankind, either by showing that it does not exist, or that it does exist and must be removed, I would be pleased. I see. Dr. Dennison, to discuss another point at the moment, my predecessor, the retiring commissioner, Mr. Montez, tells me that the growing edge of science is here on the moon. He seems to think a disproportionate quantity of the brains and initiative of mankind is here. He may be right, said Dennison. I don't know. He may be right, agreed Gottstein thoughtfully. If so, doesn't it strike you that this may be inconvenient for your purpose? Whatever you do, men may say and think it was accomplished through the lunar scientific structure. You personally might gain little in the way of recognition, however valuable the results you present, which, of course, would be unjust. I am tired of the rat race of credit, Commissioner Gottstein. I want some interest in life, more interest than I can find as vice president in charge of ultrasonic depilatories. I'll find it in a return to science. If I accomplish something in my own eyes, I will be satisfied. Let us say that that would be insufficient for me. What credit you earn, you should receive, and it should be quite possible for me, as commissioner, to present the facts to the terrestrial community in such a way as to preserve for you what is yours. Surely you are human enough to want what is your own. You are kind, and in return... You are cynical, but justly so. In return, I want your help. The retiring commissioner, Mr. Montez, is not certain as to the lines of scientific research being undertaken on the moon. Communications between the peoples of Earth and Moon are not perfect, and the coordination of the efforts on both worlds is clearly for the benefit of all. It is understandable that there's distrust, I suppose, but if you can do anything to break down that distrust, it will be as valuable to us as your scientific findings might be. Surely, Commissioner, you can't feel that I'm the ideal man to bear witness to the Lunarites as to how fair-meaning and well-disposed the Earth's scientific establishment is. You mustn't confuse one vengeful scientist with the men of Earth as a whole, Dr. Dennison. Let's put it this way. I would appreciate being kept aware of your scientific findings so that I could help you retain your fair share of credit. And in order to understand your findings properly, I am not a professional scientist myself, remember, it would be helpful if you were to explain them in the light of the present state of science on the moon. Is it agreed? Dennison said, "You ask a hard thing. Preliminary results, prematurely disclosed, whether through carelessness or over-enthusiasm, can do tremendous harm to a reputation. I would hate to talk about anything to anyone until I was sure of my ground. My earlier experience with the committee on which you served would certainly encourage me to be cautious." "I quite understand," said Gottstein heartily. "I would leave it to you to decide when I might usefully be informed. But I have kept you late, and you probably want to sleep." Which was a dismissal. Dennison left, and Gottstein looked after him thoughtfully. 7. Dennison opened the door by hand. There was a contact that would have opened it automatically, but in the blur of waking he could not find it. The dark-haired man, with a face that was somehow scowling in repose, said, "I'm sorry. Am I early?" Dennison repeated the last word to give him time to absorb matters. "Early? No, I'm late, I think." "I called. We made an appointment." And now Dennison had it. "Yes, you're Dr. Neville." "That's right. May I come in?" He stepped in as he asked. Dennison's room was small and held a rumpled bed that took up most of the available space. The ventilator was sighing softly. Neville said with meaningless courtesy, "Slept well, I hope?" Dennison looked down at his pajamas and passed his hand over his rumpled hair. "No," he said abruptly, "I had an abominable night. May I be excused long enough to make myself more presentable?" "Of course. Would you like to have me prepare breakfast meanwhile? You may be unacquainted with the equipment." "It would be a favor," said Dennison. He emerged some 20 minutes later, washed and shaved, wearing trousers and an undershirt. He said, "I trust I didn't break the shower. It went off, and I couldn't turn it on again." "The water's rationed. You only get so much. This is the moon, Doctor. I've taken the liberty of preparing scrambled eggs and hot soup for the two of us." "Scrambled?" "We call it that. Earthmen wouldn't, I suppose." Dennison said, "Oh." He sat down with something less than enthusiasm and tasted the pasty yellow mixture that clearly was what the other meant by scrambled eggs. He tried not to make a face at the first taste, and then manfully swallowed it and dug in for a second forkful. "You'll get used to it with time," said Neville, "and it's highly nourishing. I might warn you that the high protein content and the low gravity will cut your need for food." "Just as well," said Dennison, clearing his throat. Neville said, "Celody tells me that you intend to stay on the moon." Dennison said, "That was my intention." He rubbed his eyes. "I've had a terrible night, though. It tests my resolution." "How many times did you fall out of bed?" "Twice. I take it that the situation is a common one." "For men of Earth, an invariable one. Awake, you can make yourself walk with due regard for the moon's gravity. Asleep, you toss as you would on Earth. But at least falling is not painful at low gravity." "The second time, I slept on the floor a while before waking. Didn't remember falling. What the hell do you do about it?" "You mustn't neglect your periodic checks on heartbeat, blood pressure, and so on, just to make sure the gravity change isn't introducing too much of a strain." "I've been amply warned of that," said Dennison with distaste. "In fact, I have fixed appointments for the next month, and pills." "Well," said Neville, as if dismissing a triviality, Within a week you'll probably have no trouble at all, and you'll need proper clothing. Those trousers will never do, and that flimsy upper garment serves no purpose. I presume there's some place I can buy clothes. Of course. If you can get her when she's off duty, Selene will be glad to help you, I'm sure. She assures me you're a decent sort, Doctor. I'm delighted she thinks so. Dennison, having swallowed a spoonful of the soup, looked at it as though he were wondering what to do with the rest. Grimly, he continued the task of downing it. She judged you to be a physicist, but of course she's wrong. I was trained as a radiochemist. You haven't worked at that either for a long time, Doctor. We may be out of it up here, but we're not that far out of it. You're one of Hallam's victims. Are there so many? You speak of them as a group. Why not? The whole moon is one of Hallam's victims.
The moon?
In a manner of speaking. I don't understand. We have no electron pump stations on the moon. None have been established because there has been no cooperation from the para-universe. No samples of tungsten have been accepted. Surely, Dr. Neville, you don't intend to imply that this is Hallam's doing. In a negative way, yes. Why must it be only the para-universe which can initiate a pump station? Why not ourselves? As far as I know, we lack the knowledge to take the initiative. And we will continue to lack the knowledge if research into the matter is forbidden. Is it forbidden? Dennison asked with a faint note of surprise. In effect, if none of the work necessary to expand knowledge in that direction find adequate priorities at the proton synchrotron, or at any of the other large equipment, all controlled by Earth, and all under the influence of Hallam, then the research is effectively forbidden. Dennison rubbed his eyes. I suspect I will have to sleep again before long. I beg your pardon. I did not mean to imply you were boring me. But tell me, is the electron pump so important to the moon? Surely the solar batteries are effective and sufficient. They tie us to the sun, Doctor. They tie us to the surface. Well, but why does Hallam take this adverse interest in the matter, do you suppose, Dr. Neville? You know better than I, if you know him personally, as I do not. He prefers not to make it clear to the public generally that the entire electron pump establishment is the product of the paramen, with ourselves merely servants of the masters. And if, on the moon, we advance to the point where we ourselves know what we are doing, then the birth of the true electron pump technology will date from our moment, not from his. Dennison said, "Why do you tell me all this?" "To avoid wasting my time. Ordinarily, we welcome physicists from Earth. We feel cut off here on the moon, victims of deliberate terrestrial policy against us. And a physicist visitor can be helpful, even if only to give us a feeling of lesser isolation. A physicist immigrant is even more helpful, and we like to explain the situation to him and encourage him to work with us. I am sorry that you are not, after all, a physicist." Dennison said impatiently, "But I never said I was." "And yet you asked to see the synchrotron. Why?" "Is that really what's bothering you? My dear sir, let me try to explain. My scientific career was ruined half a lifetime ago. I have decided to seek some sort of rehabilitation, some sort of renewed meaning to my life as far away from Hallam as I could get, which means here on the moon. I was trained as a radiochemist, but that has not permanently paralyzed me as far as any other field of endeavor is concerned. Paraphysics is the great field of today, and I have done my best to self-educate myself there, feeling that this will offer me my best hope for rehabilitation." Neville nodded. "I see," he said with clear dubiousness. "By the way, since you mentioned the electron pump, have you heard anything about the theories of Peter Lamont?" Neville eyed the other narrowly. "No, I don't think I know the man." "Yes, he is not yet famous, and probably never will be, chiefly for the same reason I'll never be. He crossed Hallam." His name came up recently, and I've been giving him some thought. It was one way of occupying the sleepless portion of last night. And he yawned. Neville said impatiently, "Yes, Doctor? What of this man? What is his name?" "Peter Lamont. He has some interesting thoughts on paratheory. He believes that with continued use of the pump, the strong nuclear interaction will grow basically more intense in the space of the solar system, and that the sun will slowly heat up and, at some crucial point, undergo a phase change that will produce an explosion." "Nonsense! Do you know the amount of change produced on a cosmic scale of any use of the pump on a human scale? Even granted that you are only self-educated in physics, you ought to have no difficulty in seeing that the pump can't possibly make any appreciable change in general universal conditions during the lifetime of the solar system."
"You think so?"
"Of course. Don't you?" said Neville. "I'm not sure. Lamont's grinding a personal axe. I've met him briefly, and he impressed me as an intense and very emotional fellow. Considering what Hallam has done to him, he is probably driven by overwhelming anger." Neville frowned. He said, "Are you sure he is on the outs with Hallam?" "I'm an expert on the subject." "It doesn't occur to you that the initiation of that kind of doubt, that the pump is dangerous, might be used as but another device to keep the moon from developing stations of its own?" "At the cost of creating universal alarm and despondency? Of course not. That would be cracking walnuts with nuclear explosions. No, I'm sure Lamont is sincere. In fact, in my own bumbling way, I had similar notions once." "Because you, too, are driven by hate for Hallam." "I'm not Lamont. I imagine I don't react the same way he does. In fact, I had some dim hope I would be able to investigate the matter on the moon without Hallam's interference and without Lamont's emotionalism." "Here on the moon?" "Here on the moon. I thought perhaps I might get the use of the synchrotron." "And that was your interest in it?" Dennison nodded. Neville said, "You really think you will get the use of the synchrotron? Do you know how far back the requisitions have piled up?" "I thought perhaps I might get the cooperation of some of the lunar scientists." Neville laughed and shook his head. "We have almost as little chance as you. However, I'll tell you what we can do. We have established laboratories of our own. We can give you space. We might even have some minor instrumentation for you. How useful our facilities would be to you, I can't say, but you might be able to do something." "Do you suppose I would have any means there of making observations useful to paratheory?" "It would depend partly on your ingenuity, I suppose. Do you expect to prove the theories of this man, Lamont?"
"Or disprove them, perhaps."
"You'll disprove them, if anything at all. I have no fears about that." Dennison said, "It's quite clear, isn't it, that I'm not a physicist by training? Why do you so readily offer me working space?" "Because you're from Earth. I told you that we value that, and perhaps your self-education as a physicist will be of additional value. Selene vouches for you, something I attach more importance to than I should, perhaps. And we are fellow sufferers at the hands of Hallam. If you wish to rehabilitate yourself, we will help you." "But pardon me if I am cynical. What do you expect to get out of it?" "Your help. There is a certain amount of misunderstanding between the scientists of the Earth and the Moon. You are a man of Earth who has come voluntarily to the Moon, and you could act as a bridge between us to the benefit of both. You have already had contact with the new commissioner, and it may be possible that, as you rehabilitate yourself, you will rehabilitate us as well." "You mean that if what I do weakens Hallam's influence, that will benefit lunar science as well?" "Whatever you do is sure to be useful. But perhaps I ought to leave you to catch up with your sleep. Call on me during the next couple of days, and I will see about placing you in the laboratory. And," he looked about, "getting you somewhat more comfortable quarters as well." They shook hands, and Neville left. 8. Gottstein said, "I suppose that, however annoying this position of yours may have been, you are getting ready to leave it today with a small pang." Montez shrugged eloquently. "A very large pang, when I think of the return to full gravity. The difficulty of breathing, the aching feet, the perspiration. I'll be in a bath of perspiration constantly. It will be my turn some day. Take my advice. Never stay here longer than 2 months at a time. I don't care what the doctors tell you or what kind of isometric exercises they put you through. Get back to Earth every 60 days and stay at least a week. You've got to keep the feel of it."
"I'll bear that in mind. Oh, I've been in touch with my friend."
"Which friend is that?"
"The man who was on the vessel with me when I came in. I thought I remembered him, and I did. A man named Dennison, a radiochemist. What I remembered of him was accurate enough."
"Ah?"
"I remembered a certain interesting irrationality of his, and tried to probe it. He resisted in quite a shrewd fashion. He sounded rational. So rational, in fact, that I grew suspicious. There's a kind of attractive rationality developed by certain types of crackpots, a kind of defense mechanism."
"Oh, Lord," said Montez, clearly harassed. "I'm not sure I follow you. If you don't mind, I'm going to sit down for a moment. Between trying to determine whether everything is properly packed and thinking about Earth's gravity, I'm out of breath."
"What kind of irrationality?"
"He tried to tell us once that there was danger in the use of the electron pump. He thought it would blow up the universe."
"Indeed? And will it?"
"I hope not. At the time, it was dismissed rather brusquely. When scientists work on a subject at the limit of understanding, they grow edgy, you know. I knew a psychiatrist once who called it the who knows phenomenon. If nothing you do will give you the knowledge you need, you end by saying, 'Who knows what will happen?' And imagination tells you."
"Yes, but if physicists go around saying such things, even a few of them..."
"They don't. Not officially. There's such a thing as scientific responsibility, and the journals are careful not to print nonsense, or what they consider nonsense. Actually, you know, the subjects come up again. A physicist named Lamont spoke to Senator Burt, to that self-appointed environmental messiah Chen, and to a few others. He also insists on the possibility of cosmic explosion. No one believes him, but the story spreads in a thin sort of way, and gets better with the retelling."
"And this man here on the moon believes it?"
Gottstein smiled broadly. "I suspect he does. Hell, in the middle of the night, when I have trouble sleeping, I keep falling out of bed, by the way, I believe it myself. He probably hopes to test the theory experimentally here."
"Well?"
"Well, let him. I hinted we would help him."
Montez shook his head.
"That's risky. I don't like the official encouragement of crackpot notions."
"You know, it's just barely possible they may not be entirely crackpot. But that's not the point. The point is that if we can get him established here on the moon, we may find out, through him, what's going on here. He's anxious for rehabilitation, and I hinted that rehabilitation would come through us if he cooperated. I'll see to it that you are discreetly kept posted, as between friends, you know."
"Thank you," said Montez, "and goodbye."
9.
Neville chafed.
"No, I don't like him."
"Why not? Because he's an earthy?"
Selene brushed a bit of fluff from her right breast, then caught it and looked at it critically.
"That's not from my blouse. I tell you, the air recirculation is abominable. This Dennison is worthless. He is not a paraphysicist. He's a self-educated man in the field, he says, and proves it by coming here with ready-made damn-fool notions."
"Like what?"
"He thinks that the electron pump is going to explode the universe."
"Did he say that?"
"I know he thinks that. Oh, I know the arguments. I've heard them often enough. But it's not so, that's all."
"Maybe," said Selene, raising her eyebrows, "you just don't want it to be so."
"Don't you start," said Neville.
There was a short pause. Selene said, "Well, what will you do with him?"
"I'll give him a place to work. He may be worthless as a scientist, but he'll have his uses just the same. He'll be conspicuous enough. The commissioner has been talking to him already."
"I know."
"Well, he has a romantic history as someone with a wrecked career trying to rehabilitate himself."
"Really?"
"Really. I'm sure you'll love it. If you ask him about it, he'll tell you. And that's good. If we have a romantic Earthman working on the moon on a crackpot project, you'll make a perfect object to preoccupy the commissioner. He'll be misdirection, window dressing. And it may even be that through him, who knows, we might just possibly get a better idea of what goes on there on Earth. You'd better continue to be friendly with him, Selene."
10.
Selene laughed, and the sound was metallic in Dennison's earpiece. Her figure was lost in the spacesuit she wore. She said, "Now come, then. There's no reason to be afraid. You're an old hand by now. You've been here a month."
28 days, mumbled Dennison. He felt smothered in his own suit.
"A month," insisted Selene. "It was well past half-Earth when you came. It is well past half-Earth now." She pointed to the brilliant curve of the Earth in the southern sky.
"Well, but wait. I'm not as brave out here as I am underground. What if I fall?"
"What if you do? The gravity is weak by your standards. The slope is gentle. Your suit is strong. If you fall, just let yourself slide and roll. It's almost as much fun that way anyhow."
Dennison looked about doubtfully. The moon lay beautiful in the cold light of the Earth. It was black and white, a mild and delicate white, as compared with the sunlit views he had seen when he had taken a trip a week before to inspect the solar batteries that stretched from horizon to horizon along the floor of Mare Imbrium. And the black was somehow softer, too, through lack of the blazing contrast of true day. The stars were supernally bright, and the earth, was infinitely inviting, with its swirls of white on blue and its peeping glimpse of tan.
"Well," he said, "do you mind if I hang on to you?"
"Of course not. And we won't go all the way up. It will be the beginner's slope for you. Just try to keep in time with me. I'll move slowly."
Her steps were long, slow, and swinging, and he tried to keep in synchronization. The upsloping ground beneath them was dusty, and with each step he kicked up a fine powder that settled quickly in the airlessness. He matched her stride for stride, but with an effort.
"Good," said Selene, her arm locked in his, steadying him. "You're very good for an Earthy. No, I ought to say Immy."
"Thank you." "That's not much better, I suppose. Immy for immigrant is as insulting as Earthy for Earthman. Shall I just say you're simply very good for a man your age?"
"No! That's much worse." Dennison was gasping a little, and he could feel his forehead moistening.
Selene said, "Each time you reach the point where you're about to put your foot down, give a little push with your other foot. That will lengthen your stride and make it all the easier. No, no, watch me." Dennison paused thankfully and watched Selene, somehow slim and graceful, despite the grotesquerie of the suit once she moved, take off in low, loping leaps. She returned and knelt at his feet. "Now you take a slow step, then, and I'll hit your foot when I want it to shove." They tried several times, and Dennison said,
"That's worse than running on Earth. I better rest."
"All right. It's just that your muscles aren't used to the proper coordination. It's yourself you're fighting, you know, not gravity. Well, sit down and catch your breath. I won't take you up much further."
Dennison said, "Will I do any damage to the pack if I lie down on my back?"
"No, of course not. But it's not a good idea, not on the bare ground. It's only at 120 degrees absolute, 150 degrees below zero if you prefer, and the smaller the area of contact, the better."
"I'd sit down."
"All right." Gingerly, Dennison sat down with a grunt. Deliberately, he faced northward, away from the Earth. "Look at those stars.
Selene sat facing him at right angles. He could see her face now and then dimly through the faceplate, when the earthlight caught it at the proper angle. She said, "Don't you see the stars on Earth?"
"Not like this. Even when there are no clouds, the air on Earth absorbs some of the light. Temperature differences in the atmosphere make them twinkle, and city lights, even distant city lights, wash them out."
"Sounds disgusting." "Do you like it out here, Selene, on the surface?"
"I'm not crazy about it, really, but I don't mind it too much now and then. It's part of my job to bring tourists out here, of course.
And now you have to do it for me."
"Can't I convince you it's not the same thing at all, Ben? We've got a set route for the tourists. It's very tame, very uninteresting. You don't think we'd take them out here to the slide, do you? This is for Lunarites and Immies. Mostly Immies, actually."
"It can't be very popular. There's no one here but ourselves."
"Oh, well, there are particular days for this sort of thing. You should see this place on race days. You wouldn't like it then, though."
"I'm not sure I like it now. Is gliding a sport for Immies, particularly?"
"Rather. Lunarites don't like the surface, generally."
"How about Dr. Neville?"
"You mean, how he feels about the surface?"
"Yes."
"Frankly, I don't think he's ever been up here. He's a real city boy. Why do you ask?"
"Well, when I asked permission to go along on the routine servicing of the solar batteries, he was perfectly willing to have me go, but he wouldn't go himself. I rather asked him to, I think, so I could have someone answer my questions, if there were any, and his refusal was rather strong."
"I hope there was someone else to answer your questions."
"Oh, yes. He was an Emmy, too, come to think of it. Maybe that explains Dr. Neville's attitude toward the electron pump."
"What do you mean?"
"Well..." Dennison leaned back and kicked his legs up alternately, watching them rise and fall slowly with a certain lazy pleasure.
"Hey, that's not bad. Look, Selene.
What I mean is that Neville is so intent on developing a pump station on the moon when the solar batteries are so adequate for the job. We couldn't use solar batteries on the Earth, where the sun is never as unfailing, as prolonged, as bright, as radiant in all wavelengths. There's not a single planetary body in the solar system, no body of any size, that is more suitable for the use of the batteries than the moon is. Even Mercury is too hot. But the use does tie you to the surface, and if you don't like the surface..." Selene rose to her feet suddenly and said, "All right, Ben, you've rested enough. Up, up." He struggled to his feet and said, "A pump station, however, would mean that no Lunarite would ever have to come out on the surface if he didn't want to. Up hill we go, Ben. We'll go to that ridge up ahead. See it? Where the earthlight cuts off in a horizontal line?" They made their way up the final stretch silently. Dennison was aware of the smoother area to their side, a wide swath of slope from which most of the dust had been brushed.
"That's too smooth for a beginner to work up," Selene said, answering his thoughts. "Don't get too ambitious, or you'll want me to teach you the kangaroo hop next." She made a kangaroo hop as she spoke, turned about face almost before landing, and said, "Right here. Sit down and I'll adjust."
Dennison did, facing downhill. He looked down the slope uncertainly.
"Can you really glide on it?"
"Of course. The gravity is weaker on the moon than on the Earth, so you press against the ground much less strongly, and that means there is much less friction. Everything is more slippery on the moon than on the Earth. That's why the floors in our corridors and apartments seem unfinished to you. Would you like to hear me give my little lecture on the subject, the one I give to the tourists?"
"No, Selene."
"Besides, we're going to use gliders, of course." She had a small cartridge in her hand. Clamps and a pair of thin tubes were attached to it.
"What is that?" asked Ben.
"Just a small liquid gas reservoir. It will emit a jet of vapor just under your boots. The thin gas layer between boots and ground will reduce friction to virtually zero. You'll move as though you were in clear space."
Dennison said uneasily, "I disapprove. Surely it's wasteful to use gas in this fashion on the moon.
Oh, now, what gas do you think we use in these gliders? Carbon dioxide? Oxygen?
This is waste gas to begin with. It's argon. It comes out of the moon's soil in ton lots, formed by the billions of years of breakdown of potassium-40. That's part of my lecture, too, Ben. The argon has only a few specialized uses on the moon. We could use it for gliding for 1,000,000 years without exhausting the supply.
All right, your gliders are on. Now wait till I put mine on.
How do they work?
It's quite automatic. You just start sliding, and that will trip the contact and start the vapor. You've only got a few minutes' supply, but that's all you'll need.
She stood up and helped him to his feet.
Face downhill. Come on, Ben, this is a gentle slope. Look at it. It looks perfectly level.
No, it doesn't, said Dennison sulkily. It looks like a cliff to me.
Nonsense. Now listen to me and remember what I told you. Keep your feet about 6 inches apart and one just a few inches ahead of the other. It doesn't matter which one is ahead. Keep your knees bent. Don't lean into the wind because there isn't any. Don't try to look up or back, but you can look from side to side if you have to. Most of all, when you finally hit level, don't try to stop too soon. You'll be going faster than you think. Just let the glider expire, and then friction will bring you to a slow halt.
I'll never remember all that.
Yes, you will, and I'll be right at your side to help. And if you do fall and I don't catch you, don't try to do anything. Just relax and let yourself tumble or slide. There are no boulders anywhere that you can collide with.
Dennison swallowed and looked ahead. The southward slide was gleaming in earthlight. Minute unevennesses caught more than their share of light, leaving tiny uphill patches in darkness so that there was a vague mottling of the surface. The bulging half-circle of earth rode the black sky almost directly ahead.
Ready? Said Selene. Her gauntleted hand was between his shoulders.
Ready, said Dennison faintly.
Then off you go, she said. She pushed, and Dennison felt himself begin to move. He moved quite slowly at first. He turned toward her, wobbling, and she said, Don't worry, I'm right at your side.
He could feel the ground beneath his feet, and then he couldn't. The glider had been activated.
For a moment, he felt as though he were standing still. There was no push of air against his body, no feel of anything sliding past his feet. But when he turned toward Selene again, he noticed that the lights and shadows to one side were moving backward at a slowly increasing speed.
Keep your eyes on the earth, Selene's voice said in his ear, till you build up speed. The faster you go, the more stable you'll be. Keep your knees bent. You're doing very well, Ben.
For an Emmy, gasped Dennison. How does it feel?
Like flying, he said. The pattern of light and dark on either side was moving backward in a blur. He looked briefly to one side, then the other, trying to convert the sensation of a backward flight of the surroundings into one of a forward flight of his own. Then, as soon as he succeeded, he found that he had to look forward hastily at the earth again to regain his sense of balance.
I suppose that's not a good comparison to use to you. You have no experience of flying on the moon.
Now I know, though. Flying must be like gliding. I know what that is.
She was keeping up with him easily. Dennison was going fast enough now so that he got the sensation of motion even when he looked ahead. The moonscape ahead was opening up before him and flowing past on either side. He said, How fast do you get to go in a glide?
A good moon race, said Selene, has been clocked at speeds in excess of 100 miles an hour, on steeper slopes than this one, of course. You'll probably reach a top of 35.
It feels a lot faster than that, somehow.
Well, it isn't. We're leveling off now, Ben, and you haven't fallen. Now just hang on. The glider will die off, and you'll feel friction. Don't do anything to help it. Just keep going.
Selene had barely completed her remarks when Dennison felt the beginning of pressure under his boots. There was at once an overwhelming sensation of speed, and he clenched his fists hard to keep from throwing his arms up in an almost reflex gesture against the collision that wasn't going to happen. He knew that if he threw up his arms, he would go over backward. He narrowed his eyes, held his breath till he thought his lungs would explode, and then Selene said, "Perfect, Ben, perfect. I've never known an Emmy to go through his first slide without a fall, so if you do fall, there'll be nothing wrong, no disgrace." "I don't intend to fall," whispered Dennison. He caught a large, ragged breath and opened his eyes wide. The earth was as serene as ever, as uncaring. He was moving more slowly now, more slowly, more slowly. "Am I standing still now, Selene?" he asked. "I'm not sure." "You're standing still. Now don't move. You've got to rest before we make the trip back to town. Damn it, I left it somewhere around here when we came up." Dennison watched her with disbelief. She had climbed up with him, had glided down with him. Yet he was half dead with weariness and tension, and she was in the air with long kangaroo leaps. She seemed 100 yards away when she said, "Here it is," and her voice was as loud in his ears as when she was next to him. She was back in a moment with a folded, paunchy sheet of plastic under her arm. "Remember," she said cheerily, "when you asked what it was on our way up, and I said we'd be using it before we came down?" She unfolded it and spread it on the dusty surface of the moon. "A lunar lounge is its full name," she said, "but we just call it a lounge. We take the adjective for granted here on this world." She inserted a cartridge and tripped a lever. It began to fill. Somehow Dennison had expected a hissing noise, but of course there was no air to carry sound. "Before you question our conservation policies again," said Selene, "this is argon also." It blossomed into a mattress on 6 stubby legs. "It will hold you," she said. "It makes very little actual contact with the ground, and the vacuum all around will conserve its heat." "Don't tell me it's hot," said Dennison, amazed. "The argon is heated as it pours in, but only relatively. It ends up at 270 degrees absolute, almost warm enough to melt ice, and quite warm enough to keep your insulated suit from losing heat faster than you can manufacture it. Go ahead, lie down." Dennison did so with a sensation of enormous luxury. "Great," he said with a long sigh. "Mama Selene thinks of everything," she said. She came from behind him now, gliding around him, her feet placed heel to heel as though she were on skates, and then let them fly out from under her as she came down gracefully on hip and elbow on the ground just beside him. Dennison whistled. "How did you do that?" "Lots of practice. And don't you try it. You'll break your elbow. I warn you, though, if I get too cold, I'm going to have to crowd you on the lounge." "Safe enough," he said, "with both of us in suits." "Ah, there speaks my brave lecher. How do you feel?" "All right, I guess. What an experience." "What an experience? You set a record for non-falls. Do you mind if I tell the folks back in town about this?" "No. Always like to be appreciated. You're not going to expect me to do this again, are you?" "Right now? Of course not. I wouldn't myself. We'll just rest a while, make sure your heart action is back to normal, and then we'll go back. If you'll reach your legs in my direction, I'll take your gliders off. Next time, I'll show you how to handle the gliders yourself." "I'm not sure that there will be a next time." "Of course there'll be. Didn't you enjoy it?" "A little. In between terror." "You'll have less terror next time, and still less the time after. And eventually you'll just experience the enjoyment, and I'll make a racer out of you." "No, you won't. I'm too old." "Not on the moon. You just look old." Dennison could feel the ultimate quiet of the moon soaking into him as he lay there. He was facing the earth this time. Its steady presence in the sky had, more than anything else, given him the sensation of stability during his recent glide, and he felt grateful to it. He said, "Do you often come out here, Selene? I mean, by yourself, or just one or two others? You know, when it isn't fiesta time?
Practically never. Unless there are people around, this is too much for me. That I'm doing it now actually surprises me.
Uh-huh, said Dennison noncommittally.
You're not surprised?
Should I be? My feeling is that each person does what he does, either because he wants to or he must, and in either case that's his business, not mine.
Thanks, Ben. I mean it. It's good to hear. One of the nice things about you, Ben, is that for an Emmy, you're willing to let us be ourselves. We're underground people, we Lunarites. Cave people. Corridor people. And what's wrong with that?
Nothing.
Not to hear the Earthies talk, and I'm a tourist guide and have to listen to them. There isn't anything they say that I haven't heard a million times, but what I hear most of all, and she dropped into the clipped accents of the typical Earthy speaking planetary standard.
But dear, however can all you people live in caves all the time? Doesn't it give you a terrible closed-in feeling? Don't you ever want to see blue sky and trees and ocean, and feel wind and smell flowers?
Oh, I could go on and on, then. Then they say,
but I suppose you don't know what blue sky and sea and trees are like, so you don't miss them. As if we don't receive Earth television, and as if we don't have full access to Earth literature, both optical and auditory, and olfactory sometimes, too.
Dennison was amused. He said, what's the official answer to remarks like that?
Nothing much. We just say, we're quite used to it, madam, or sir, if it's a man.
Usually it's a woman. The men are too interested in studying our blouses and wondering when we take them off, I suppose.
You know what I'd like to tell the idiots?
Please tell me. As long as you have to keep the blouse on, it being inside the suit, at least get that off your chest.
Funny, funny wordplay. I'd like to tell them, look, madam, why the hell should we be interested in your damned world? We don't want to be hanging on the outside of any planet and waiting to fall off or get blown off. We don't want raw air puffing at us and dirty water falling on us. We don't want your damned germs and your smelly grass and your dull blue sky and your dull white clouds. We can see Earth in our own sky when we want to, and we don't often want to. The moon is our home, and it's what we make it. Exactly what we make it. We own it, and we build our own ecology, and we don't need you here being sorry for us going our own way. Go back to your own world and let your gravity pull your breasts down to your knees. That's what I'd say.
Dennison said, all right. Whenever you get too close to saying that to some Earthy, come say it to me and you feel better.
You know what? Every once in a while, some Emmy suggests that we build an Earth park on the moon. Some little spot with earth plants brought in as seeds or seedlings, maybe some animals. A touch of home, that's the usual expression.
I take it you're against that.
Of course I'm against it. A touch of whose home? The moon is our home. And Emmy who wants a touch of home had better get back to his home. Emmys can be worse than Earthies sometimes.
I'll keep that in mind, said Dennison.
Not you, so far, said Selene. There was silence for a moment, and Dennison wondered if Selene were going to suggest a return to the caverns. On the one hand, it wouldn't be long before he would feel a fairly strenuous craving to visit a restroom. On the other, he had never felt so relaxed. He wondered how long the oxygen in his pack would hold out. Then Selene said, Ben, do you mind if I ask you a question?
Not at all. If it's my private life that interests you, I am without secrets. I'm 5'9", weigh 28 pounds on the moon, had one wife long ago, now divorced, one child, a daughter, grown up and married, attended university of...
No, Ben, I'm serious. Can I ask about your work?
Of course you can, Selene. I don't know how much I can explain to you, though.
Well, you know that Baron and I...
Yes, I know, said Dennison brusquely.
We talk together. He tells me things sometimes. He said you think the electron pump might make the universe explode.
Our section of the universe. It might convert a part of our galactic arm into a quasar.
Really? Do you really think so?
Dennison said, when I came to the moon, I wasn't sure. Now I am.
I am personally convinced that this will happen.
When do you think it will happen?
That I can't say exactly. Maybe a few years from now, maybe a few decades.
There was a short silence between them. Then Selene said in a subdued voice, Baron doesn't think so.
I know he doesn't. I'm not trying to convert him. You don't beat refusal to believe in a frontal attack. That's Lamont's mistake.
Who's Lamont?
I'm sorry, Selene. I'm talking to myself.
No, Ben, please tell me. I'm interested. Please?
Dennison turned to one side, facing her. All right, he said. I have no objection to telling you. Lamont, a physicist back on Earth, tried in his way to alert the world to the dangers of the pump. He failed. Earthmen want the pump. They want the free energy. They want it enough to refuse to believe they can't have it.
But why should they want it if it means death?
All they have to do is to refuse to believe it means death. The easiest way to solve a problem is to deny it exists. Your friend, Dr. Neville, does the same thing. He dislikes the surface, so he forces himself to believe that solar batteries are no good, even though to any impartial observer they would seem the perfect energy source for the moon. He wants the pump so he can stay underground, so he refuses to believe there can be any danger from it.
Selene said, I don't think Baron would refuse to believe something for which valid evidence existed. Do you really have the evidence?
I think I do. It's most amazing, really, Selene. The whole thing depends on certain subtle factors of quark-quark interactions. Do you know what that means?
You don't have to explain. I've talked so much to Baron about all sorts of things that I might be able to follow you.
Well, I thought I would need the lunar proton synchrotron for the purpose. It's 25 miles across, has superconducting magnets, and can dispose of energies of 20,000 BeV and more. It turns out, though, that you people have something you call a pionizer, which fits into a moderately sized room and does all the work of the synchrotron. The moon is to be congratulated on a most amazing advance.
Thank you, said Selene complacently. I mean, on behalf of the moon.
Well, then, my pionizer results can show the rate of increase of intensity of strong nuclear interaction. And the increase is what Lamont says it is, and not what the orthodox theory would have it be.
And have you shown it to Baron?
No, I haven't. And if I do, I expect Neville to reject it. He'll say the results are marginal. He'll say I've made an error. He'll say that I haven't taken all factors into account. He'll say I've used inadequate controls. What he'll really be saying is that he wants the electron pump and won't give it up.
You mean there's no way out?
Of course there is, but not the direct way, not Lamont's way.
What's that?
Lamont's solution is to force abandonment of the pump. But you can't just move backward. You can't push the chicken back into the egg, wine back into the grape, the boy back into the womb. If you want the baby to let go of your watch, you don't just try to explain that he ought to do it. You offer him something he would rather have.
What's that?
Ah, that's where I'm not so sure. I do have an idea, a simple idea, perhaps too simple to work, based on the quite obvious fact that the number 2 is ridiculous and can't exist.
There was a silence that lasted for a minute or so, and then Selene, her voice as absorbed as his, said, Let me guess your meaning.
I don't know that I have any, said Dennison.
Let me guess anyway. It could make sense to suppose that our own universe is the only one that can exist or does exist, because it is the only one we live in and directly experience. Once, however, evidence arises that there is a second universe as well, the one we call the para-universe, then it becomes absolutely ridiculous to suppose that there are 2 and only 2 universes. If a second universe can exist, then an infinite number can. Between 1 and the infinite, in cases such as these, there are no sensible numbers. Not only 2, but any finite number is ridiculous and can't exist.
Dennison said, That's exactly my reason,
and silence fell again.
Dennison heaved himself into a sitting position and looked down on the suit-encased girl. He said, I think we had better go back to town.
She said, I was just guessing. He said, no, you weren't. Whatever it wasn't just guessing.
11. Baron Neville stared at her, quite speechless for a while. She looked calmly back at him. Her window panorama had been changed again. One of them now showed the earth, a little more than half full. Finally, he said, why? She said, it was an accident, really. I saw the point, and I was too enthusiastic not to speak. I should have told you days ago, but I was afraid your reaction would be exactly what it is.
So he knows. You fool!
She frowned.
What does he know?
Only what he would have guessed, sooner or later, that I'm not really a tourist guide, that I'm your intuitionist, an intuitionist who knows no mathematics, for heaven's sake.
So what if he knows that? What does it matter if I have intuition? How many times have you told me that my intuition has no value till it is backed by mathematical rigor and experimental observation? How many times have you told me that the most compelling intuition could be wrong? Well, then, what value will he place on mere intuitionism?
Neville grew white, but Selene couldn't tell whether that was out of anger or apprehension. He said,
you're different. Hasn't your intuition always proved right, when you were sure of it?
Ah, but he doesn't know that, does he?
He'll guess it. He'll see Gottstein.
What will he tell Gottstein? He still has no idea of what we're really after.
Doesn't he?
No. She had stood up, walked away. Now she turned to him and shouted,
no! It's cheap of you to imply that I would betray you and the rest. If you don't accept my integrity, then accept my common sense. There's no point in telling them. What's the use of it to them or to us, if we're all going to be destroyed?
Oh, please, Selene. Neville waved his hand in disgust.
Not that.
No, you listen. He talked to me and described his work. You hide me like a secret weapon. You tell me that I'm more valuable than any instrument or any ordinary scientist. You play your games of conspiracy, insisting that everyone must continue to think me a tourist guide and nothing more, so that my great talents will always be available to the Lunarites. To you. And what do you accomplish?
We have you, haven't we? How long do you suppose you would have remained free if they...
You keep saying things like that. But who's been imprisoned? Who's been stopped? Where is the evidence of the great conspiracy you see all around you? The Earthmen keep you and your team from their large instruments much more because you goad them into it than out of any malice on their part. And that's done us good rather than harm, since it's forced us to invent other instruments that are more subtle.
Based on your theoretical insight, Selene.
Selene smiled. I know. Ben was very complimentary about them.
You and your Ben. What the hell do you want with that miserable earthy?
He's an immigrant. And what I want is information. Do you give me any?
You're so damned afraid I'll be caught. You don't dare let me be seen talking to any physicist. Only you. And you're my...
For that reason only, probably.
Now, Selene.
He tried to manage a soothing tone, but there was far too much impatience to it.
No, I don't care about that, really. You've told me I have this one task, and I've tried to concentrate on it, and sometimes I think I have it, mathematics or not. I can visualize it, the kind of thing that must be done, and then it slips away. But what's the use of it, when the pump will destroy us all anyway? Haven't I told you I distrusted the exchange of field intensities?
Neville said, I'll ask you again. Are you ready to tell me that the pump will destroy us? Never mind might, never mind could, never mind anything but will.
Selene shook her head angrily. I can't. It's so marginal. I can't say it will. But isn't a simple might sufficient in such a case?
Oh, Lord.
Don't turn up your eyes. Don't sneer. You've never tested the matter. I told you how it might be tested.
You were never this worried about it till you started listening to this earthy of yours.
He's an immigrant. Aren't you going to test it?
No. I told you your suggestions were impractical. You're not an experimentalist, and what looks good in your mind doesn't necessarily work in the real world of instruments, of randomness, and of uncertainty.
the so-called real world of your laboratory." Her face was flushed and angry, and she held her clenched fists at chin level. "You waste so much time trying to get a vacuum good enough. There's a vacuum up there on the surface where I'm pointing, with temperatures that at times are halfway down toward absolute zero. Why don't you try experiments on the surface?"
It would have been useless.
"How do you know? You just won't try. Ben Dennison tried. He took the trouble to devise a system he could use on the surface, and he set it up when he went to inspect the solar batteries. He wanted you to come and you wouldn't. Do you remember? It was a very simple thing, something even I could describe to you now that it's been described to me. He ran it at day temperatures and again at night temperatures, and that was enough to guide him to a new line of research with the pionizer."
"How simple you make it sound."
"How simple it is. Once he found out I was an intuitionist, he talked to me as you never did. He explained his reasons for thinking that the strengthening of the strong nuclear interaction is indeed accumulating catastrophically in the neighborhood of Earth. It will only be a few years before the sun explodes and sends the strengthening in ripples."
"No, no, no, no!" shouted Neville. "I've seen his results and I'm not impressed."
"You've seen them?"
"Yes, of course. Do you suppose I let him work in our laboratories without making sure I know what he's doing? I've seen his results, and they're worth nothing. He deals with tiny deviations that are well within the experimental error. If he wants to believe that these deviations have significance, and if you want to believe them, go ahead. But no amount of belief will make them have that significance if, in fact, they don't."
"What do you want to believe, Baron?"
"I want the truth."
"But haven't you decided in advance what the truth must be by your own gospel? You want the pump station of the moon, don't you, so that you need have nothing to do with the surface, and anything that might prevent that is not the truth, by definition."
"I won't argue with you. I want the pump station, and even more, I want the other. One's no good without the other."
"Are you sure you haven't?"
"I haven't.
Will you?" Selenie whirled on him again, her feet tapping rapidly on the ground in such a way as to keep her bobbing in the air to the tune of an angry clatter. "I won't tell him anything," she said, "but I must have more information. You have no information for me, but he may have, or he may get it with the experiments you won't do. I've got to talk to him and find out what he is going to find out. If you get between him and me, you'll never have what you want, and you needn't fear his getting it before I do. He's too used to Earth thinking. He won't make that last step. I will."
"All right. And don't forget the difference between Earth and Moon, either. This is your world. You have no other. This man, Dennison, this Ben, this immigrant, having come from Earth to Moon, can, if he chooses, return from Moon to Earth. You can never go to the Earth. Never. You are a lunarite forever."
"A moon maiden," said Selenie derisively.
"No maiden," said Neville, "though you may have to wait a long while before I confirm the matter once again."
She seemed unmoved at that.
He said, "And about this big danger of explosion, if the risk involved in changing the basic constants of a universe is so great, why haven't the paramen, who are so far advanced beyond us in technology, stopped pumping?" And he left. She faced the closed door with bunched jaw muscles. Then she said, "Because conditions are different for them and for us, you incredible jerk." But she was speaking to herself. He was gone. She kicked the lever that let down her bed, threw herself onto it, and seized. How much closer was she now to the real object for which Baron and those others had now been aiming for years? No closer. Energy. Everyone searched for energy, the magic word, the cornucopia, the one key to universal plenty. And yet, energy wasn't all. If one found energy, one could find the other, too. If one found the key to energy, the key to the other would be obvious. She knew the key to the other would be obvious if she could but grasp some subtle point that would appear obvious the moment it was grasped. Good heavens, she'd been so infected by Baron's chronic suspicion that even in her thoughts she was calling it the other. No Earthman would get that subtle point, because no Earthman had reason to look for it. Ben Dennison would find it for her then, without finding it for himself. Except that, if the universe was to be destroyed, what did anything matter? 12. Dennison tried to beat down his self-consciousness. Time and again, he made a groping motion as though to hitch upward the pants he wasn't wearing. He wore only sandals and the barest of briefs, which were uncomfortably tight. And, of course, he carried the blanket. Selenie, who was similarly accoutred, laughed. "Now, Ben, there's nothing wrong with your bare body, barring a certain flabbiness. It's perfectly in fashion here. In fact, take off your briefs if they're binding you."
"No," muttered Dennison. He shifted the blanket so that it draped over his abdomen, and she snatched it from him. She said, "Now give me that thing. What kind of a lunarite will you make if you bring your Earth Puritanism here? You know that prudery is only the other side of prurience. The words are even on the same page in the dictionary."
"I have to get used to it, Selenie." "You might start by looking at me once in a while, without having your glance slide off me as though I were coated with oil. You look at other women quite efficiently, I notice."
"If I look at you, then you'll seem too interested and you'll be embarrassed. But if you look hard, you'll get used to it and you'll stop noticing. Look, I'll stand still and you stare. I'll take off my briefs."
Dennison groaned. "Selenie, there are people all around and you're making intolerable fun of me. Please keep walking and let me get used to the situation."
"All right, but I hope you notice the people who pass us don't look at us."
"They don't look at you. They look at me, all right. They've probably never seen so old-looking and ill-shaped a person."
"They probably haven't," agreed Selenie cheerfully. "But they'll just have to get used to it."
Dennison walked on in misery, conscious of every gray hair on his chest and of every quiver of his paunch. It was only when the passageway thinned out and the people passing them were fewer in number that he began to feel a certain relief. He looked about him curiously now, not as aware of Selenie's conical breasts as he had been, nor of her smooth thighs. The corridor seemed endless.
"How far have we come?" he asked. "Are you tired?" Selenie was contrite. "We could have taken a scooter. I forget you're from Earth."
"I should hope you do. Isn't that the ideal for an immigrant? I'm not the least bit tired. Hardly the least bit tired, at any rate. What I am is a little cold."
"Purely your imagination, Ben," said Selenie firmly. "You just think you ought to feel cold because so much of you is bare. Put it out of your head."
"Easy to say," he sighed. "I'm walking well, I hope."
"Very well. I'll have you kangarooing yet. And participating in glider races down the surface slopes. Remember, I'm moderately advanced in years. But really, how far have we come?"
2 miles, I should judge."
"Good Lord! How many miles of corridors are there altogether?"
"I'm afraid I don't know. The residential corridors make up comparatively little of the total. There are the mining corridors, the geological ones, the industrial, the mycological. I'm sure there must be several hundred miles altogether."
"Do you have maps?"
"Of course there are maps. We can't work blind. I mean you personally."
"Well, no, not with me. But I don't need maps for this area. It's quite familiar to me. I used to wander about here as a child. These are old corridors. Most of the new corridors, and we average 2 or 3 miles of new corridors a year, I think, are in the north. I couldn't work my way through them without a map, for untold sums, maybe not even with a map."
"Where are we heading?"
"I promised you an unusual sight. No, not me, so don't say it, and you'll have it. It's the moon's most unusual mine, and it's completely off the ordinary tourist trails."
"Don't tell me you've got diamonds on the moon."
"Better than that."
The corridor walls were unfinished here, gray rock, dimly but adequately lit by patches of electroluminescence. The temperature was comfortable and at a steady mildness, with ventilation so gently effective there was no sensation of wind. It was hard to tell here that a couple of 100 feet above were the surface subjected to alternate frying and freezing as the sun came and went on its grand bi-weekly swing from horizon to horizon, and then underneath and back.
"Is all this airtight?" asked Dennison, suddenly uncomfortably aware that he was not far below the bottom of an ocean of vacuum that extended upward through all infinity.
"Oh, yes. Those walls are impervious. They're all booby-trapped, too. If the air pressure drops as much as 10% in any section of the corridors, there is such a hooting and howling from sirens as you've never heard, and such a flashing of arrows and blazing of signs directing you to safety as you've never seen."
"How often did this happen?"
"Not often. I don't think anyone has been killed through airlack for at least 5 years."
Then, with sudden defensiveness, "You have natural catastrophes on Earth. A big quake or a tidal wave could kill thousands."
"No argument, Selene." He threw up his hands. "I surrender."
"All right," she said. "I didn't mean to get excited. Do you hear that?"
She stopped in an attitude of listening.
Dennison listened too, and shook his head.
Suddenly, he looked around.
"It's so quiet. Where is everybody? Are you sure we're not lost?"
"This isn't a natural cavern with unknown passageways. You have those on Earth, haven't you? I've seen photographs."
"Yes. Most of them are limestone caves formed by water. That certainly can't be the case of the moon, can it?"
"So we can't be lost," said Selene, smiling. "If we're alone, put it down to superstition."
"To what?"
Dennison looked startled, and his face creased in an expression of disbelief.
"Don't do that," she said. "You get all lined.
That's right, smooth out. You look much better than you did when you first arrived, you know. That's low gravity and exercise.
And trying to keep up with nude young ladies who have an uncommon amount of off time and an uncommon lack of better things to do than go on busmen's holidays."
"Now you're treating me like a tourist guide again, and I'm not nude."
"At that, even nudity is less frightening than intuitionism. But what's this about superstition?"
"Not really superstition, I suppose, but most of the people of the city tend to stay away from this part of the corridor complex."
"But why?"
"Because of what I'm going to show you."
They were walking again.
"Hear it now?"
She stopped, and Dennison listened anxiously.
He said, "You mean that small tapping sound? Tap, tap. Is that what you mean?"
She ran ahead in slow, loping strides with the slow-motion movement of the Lunarite in unhurried flight.
He followed her, attempting to ape the gait.
"Here, here."
Dennison's eye followed Selene's eagerly pointing finger.
"Good Lord," he said. "Where is it coming from?"
There was a drip of what was clearly water. A slow dripping, with each drip striking a small ceramic trough that led into the rock wall.
"From the rocks. We do have water on the moon, you know. Most of it we can bake out of gypsum, enough for our purposes, since we conserve it pretty well."
"I know, I know. I've never yet been able to manage one complete shower. How you people manage to stay clean, I don't know."
"I told you, first wet yourself, then turn off the water and smear just a little detergent on you. You rub it..."
"Oh, Ben, I'm not going through it yet again. And there's nothing on the moon to get you all that dirty anyway.
But that's not what we're talking about.
In one or two places, there are actually water deposits, usually as ice near the surface in a mountain shadow. If we locate it, it drips out. This one has been dripping since the corridor was first driven through, and that was 8 years ago."
"But why the superstition?"
"Well, obviously, water is the great material resource on which the moon depends. We drink it, wash with it, grow our food with it, make our oxygen with it, keep everything going with it. Free water can't help but get a lot of respect. Once this drip was discovered, plans to extend the tunnels in this direction were abandoned till it stopped. The corridor walls were even left unfinished."
"That sounds like superstition right there."
"Well, a kind of awe, maybe. It wasn't expected to last for more than a few months. Such drips never do. Well, After this one had passed its first anniversary, it began to seem eternal. In fact, that's what it's called, the eternal. You'll even find it marked that way on the maps. Naturally, people have come to attach importance to it, a feeling that if it stops, it will mean some sort of bad fortune.
Dennison laughed.
Selene said warmly, "No one really believes it, but everyone part believes it. You see, it's not really eternal, and it must stop sometime. As a matter of fact, the rate of drift is only about a third of what it was when it was first discovered, so that it is slowly drying. I imagine people feel that if it happened to stop when they were actually here, they would share in the bad fortune. At least, that's the rational way of explaining their reluctance to come here."
"I take it that you don't believe this."
"Whether I believe it or not isn't the point. You see, I'm quite certain that it won't stop sharply enough for anyone to be able to take the blame. It will just drift slower and slower and slower, and no one will ever be able to pinpoint the exact time when it stopped. So why worry?"
"I agree with you."
"I do, however," she said, making the transition smoothly, "have other worries, and I'd like to discuss them with you while we're alone." She spread out the blanket and sat on it cross-legged.
"Which is why you really brought me here?"
He dropped to hip and elbow, facing her. She said, "See, you can look at me easily now. You're getting used to me." And really, there were surely times on Earth when mere nudity wasn't something to be exclaimed over.
"Times and places," agreed Dennison, "but not since the passing of the crisis. In my lifetime..."
"Well, on the moon, do as the Lunarites do is a good enough guide for behavior."
"Are you going to tell me why you really brought me here, or shall I suspect you of planning seduction?"
"I could carry through seduction quite comfortably at home, thank you. This is different. The surface would have been best, but getting ready to go out on the surface would have attracted a great deal of attention. Coming here didn't, and this place is the only spot in town where we can be reasonably safe from interruption." She hesitated.
"Well," said Dennison,
"Baron is angry, very angry, in fact."
"I'm not surprised. I warned you he would be if you told him that I knew you were an intuitionist.
Why did you feel it so necessary to tell him?"
"Because it is difficult to keep things for long from my companion. Probably, though, he doesn't consider me that any longer." "I'm sorry."
"Oh, it was turning sour anyway. It's lasted long enough. What bothers me more, much more, is that he violently refuses to accept your interpretation of the pionizer experiments you ran after the surface observations."
"I told you the way it would be."
"He said he had seen your results."
He glanced at them and grunted.
"It's rather disillusioning. Does everyone just believe what he wants to?"
"As long as possible, sometimes longer."
"What about you?"
"You mean, am I human?" "Certainly. I don't believe I'm really old. I believe I'm quite attractive. I believe you seek out my company because you think I'm charming, even when you insist on turning the conversation to physics."
"No. I mean it."
"Well, I suspect Neville told you that the data I had gathered were not significant beyond the margin of error, which makes them doubtful, and that's true enough. And yet I prefer to believe they have the meaning I expected them to have to begin with."
"Just because you want to believe that?"
"Not just because. Look at it this way. Suppose there is no harm in the pump, but that I insist on thinking there is harm. In that case, I will turn out to be a fool, and my scientific reputation will be badly damaged. But I am a fool in the eyes of the people who count, and I have no scientific reputation."
"Why is that, Ben?" "You've hinted around the tale several times. Can't you tell me the whole story?"
"You'd be surprised how little there is to tell. At the age of 25, I was still such a child that I had to amuse myself by insulting a fool, for no reason other than that he was a fool. Since his folly was not his fault, I was the greater fool to do it. My insult drove him to heights he couldn't possibly have scaled otherwise."
"You're talking of Hallam?"
"Yes, of course. And as he rose, I fell. And eventually it dropped me to the moon."
"Is that so bad?"
"No, I rather think it's good.
So let's say he did me a favor, long way around. And let's get back to what I'm talking about. I've just explained that if I believe the pump to be harmful and am wrong, I lose nothing. On the other hand, if I believe the pump to be harmless and am wrong, I will be helping to destroy the world. To be sure, I've lived most of my life already, and I suppose I can argue myself into believing that I have no great cause to love humanity. However, only a few people have hurt me, and if I hurt everyone in return, that is unconscionable usury. Then, too, if you'd rather have a less noble reason, Selene, consider my daughter. Just before I left for the moon, she had applied for permission to have a child. She'll probably get it, and before long I'll be, if you don't mind my saying so, a grandfather. Somehow, I'd like to see my grandchild have a normal life expectancy. So I prefer to believe the pump is dangerous and to act on that belief. Selene said intensely, "But here's my point. Is the pump dangerous or is it not? I mean the truth, and not what anyone wants to believe." "I should ask you that. You're the intuitionist. What does your intuition say?" "But that's what bothers me, Ben. I can't make it really certain either way. I tend to feel the pump is harmful, but maybe that's because I want to believe that." "All right. Maybe you do. Why?" Selene smiled ruefully and shrugged her shoulders. "It would be fun for Baron to be wrong. When he thinks he's certain, he's so vituperatively certain. I know. You want to see his face when he's forced to back down. I'm well aware of how intense such a desire can be. For instance, if the pump were dangerous and I could prove it, I might conceivably be hailed as the savior of humanity. And yet, I swear that I'd be more interested in the look on Hallam's face. I'm not proud of that feeling, so I suspect that what I'll do is insist on an equal share of the credit with Lamont, who deserves it after all, and confine my pleasure to watching Lamont's face when he watches Hallam's face. The pettishness will then be one place removed. But I'm beginning to speak nonsense. Selene."
"Yes, then?"
"When did you find out you were an intuitionist?"
"I don't quite know."
"You took physics in college, I imagine."
"Oh, yes. Some math, too, but I was never good at that. Come to think of it, I wasn't particularly good in physics, either. I used to guess the answers when I was desperate. You know, guess what I was supposed to do to get the right answers. Very often it worked, and then I would be asked to explain why I had done what I did, and I couldn't do that very well. They suspected me of cheating, but could never prove it."
"They didn't suspect intuitionism?"
"I don't think so. But then I didn't either, until, well, one of my first sex mates was a physicist. In fact, he was the father of my child, assuming he really supplied the sperm sample. He had a physics problem, and he told me about it when we were lying in bed afterwards, just to have something to talk about, I suppose. And I said, 'You know what it sounds to me like?' and told him. He tried it just for the fun of it, he said, and it worked. In fact, that was the first step to the pionizer, which you said was much better than the proton synchrotron."
"You mean that was your idea?"
Dennison put his finger under the dripping water and paused as he was about to put it to his mouth. "Is this water safe?" "It's perfectly sterile," said Selene, "and it goes into the general reservoir for treatment. It's saturated with sulfates, carbonates, and a few other items, however. You won't like the taste." Dennison rubbed his finger on his briefs. "You invented the pionizer?"
"Not invented. I had the original concept. It took lots of development, mostly by Baron."
Dennison shook his head.
"You know, Selene, you're an amazing phenomenon. You should be under observation by the molecular biologists."
"Should I? That's not my idea of a thrill."
"About half a century ago, there came the climax to the big trend toward genetic engineering."
"I know. It flopped and was thrown out of court. It's illegal now, that whole type of study, insofar as research can be made illegal. I know people who've done work on it just the same."
"I dare say. On intuitionism?"
"No, I don't think so."
"Ah, but that's my point. At the height of the push for genetic engineering,
there was this attempt to stimulate intuitionism. Almost all the great scientists had intuitive ability, of course, and there was the feeling that this was the single great key to creativity. One could argue that superior capacity for intuition was the product of a particular gene combination, and there were all sorts of speculations as to which gene combination that was. I suspect that there are many possible types that would satisfy. And I suspect that if you are consulting your intuition here, you are correct. But there were also those who insisted that one gene, or one small related group of genes, was of particular importance to the combination, so that you might speak of an intuition gene, and then the whole thing collapsed. As I said. But before it collapsed, Dennison went on, there had been attempts to alter genes to increase the intensity of intuitionism, and there were those who insisted that some success had been achieved. The altered genes entered the gene pool, I'm positive, and if you happened to inherit, were any of your grandparents involved in the program? Not so far as I know, said Selene, but I can't rule it out. One of them might have been, for all I can say. If you don't mind, I'm not going to investigate the matter. I don't want to know. Perhaps not. The whole field grew fearfully unpopular with the general public, and anyone who can be considered the product of genetic engineering would not exactly be greeted gladly. Intuitionism, they said, for instance, was inseparable from certain undesirable characteristics. Well, thank you. They said, to possess intuition is to inspire a certain envy and enmity in others. Even as gentle and saint-like an intuitionist as Michael Faraday aroused the envy and hatred of Humphrey Davy. Who's to say that it doesn't take a certain flaw in character to be capable of arousing envy? And in your case... End of side six. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.